From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lent begins tomorrow, and in Haiti, so does a spiritual and musical festival known as Rara, which continues until Easter. On today's Fresh Air, sacred and ceremonial Haitian voodoo music. We talk with anthropologist Elizabeth McAllister about her fieldwork in Brooklyn and Haiti recording voodoo music. She'll tell us about some common misconceptions about voodoo and play selections from the new CD she's compiled, including a song written by a woman who was possessed and a healing ceremony for two men with AIDS. Also, some soul-influenced rock. We feature a performance by singer-songwriter and guitarist Dennis Brennan. And commentator Gerald Early reflects on African history and Black History Month. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The Oklahoma City bombing trial will be moved to Denver. Judge Richard Mache said the defendants could not get a fair trial anywhere in Oklahoma. Colorado Public Radio's Kelly Griffin has more.
Prosecutors said an impartial jury could be found in Oklahoma. They sought to move the trial to Tulsa, 90 miles from the site of the bombing that killed 169 people. That's so victims' families could easily attend. Attorneys for defendants Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols had asked the court to choose Denver. They said intense media coverage of the April 19th bombing would make a fair trial impossible in Oklahoma. Judge Mache agreed. In his decision today, he wrote that the interests of the victims' families to attend the trial are outweighed by the court's obligation to ensure the constitutional rights of the defendants. Mache, who presides over the U.S. District Court in Denver, did not specify which court in Colorado would handle the trial. However, he did refer to Denver as a convenient site. Mache did not set a date for the trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Kelly Griffin in Denver.
New Hampshire residents are casting ballots today in the nation's first presidential primary. Some voters went to the polls early this morning, and those results already have been tabulated. Bill Rice of New Hampshire Public Radio reports.
The tiny towns of Dixville Notch and Hart's Location, each with 29 and 23 registered voters respectively, voted shortly after midnight. The two districts combined propelled Kansas Senator Bob Dole to a narrow first-place lead with 14 votes. Lamar Alexander was right behind Dole with 13. Pat Buchanan had 5 votes, Steve Forbes 4, Dick Lugar and Phil Graham each had 1 vote, and there was a write-in for Colin Powell. In the Democratic primary, President Clinton got 12 votes. Dixville was incorporated in 1964 solely as a voting district. It experienced its first competition in getting out the first votes this year when Hart's Location residents voted to revive their long-lapsed tradition of midnight voting. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Rice in Concord, New Hampshire.
The Supreme Court said today that insurance companies are bound by the same anti-discrimination laws that apply to the rest of the housing industry. Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company had argued that fair housing laws do not mention homeowners insurance and that forcing insurance companies to comply would raise costs by making companies issue policies they otherwise would refuse. Justice Department lawyers said the government has the authority to regulate insurance companies because by denying insurance, companies effectively make housing unavailable. Talks got underway today between top NATO commander and a Bosnian Serb general who failed to appear yesterday for a scheduled meeting. The Bosnian Serb justifies the boycott of yesterday's meeting, saying their demands had not been met for the release of 2 Serb officers who had been arrested on allegations of war crimes. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 57 points. You're listening to NPR News. The World Health Organization said today it is still watching for new cases of Ebola virus following the deaths of 13 people in Gabon. The main concern now is for hospital workers who treated the victims, but health experts say they're cautiously optimistic that the outbreak has been contained. Freak snowstorms and gales wreaked havoc on much of Europe today, from Sweden to Spain and Britain to the Ukraine. Several people have died from sub-zero temperatures. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Ice and snow blanketed much of France, causing roads to be closed, electricity cuts, and delays at several airports, including the two near Paris. Air France canceled all of its medium-range flights. The airport in Bordeaux in western France was shut for a few hours. 3 people north of Paris died in a car crash because of the snowy conditions. Temperatures have dipped to single digits. The Channel Tunnel was closed because melting snow blocked the signals. In Britain, gales battered the countryside, and 1,400 homes had no electricity. But by far the worst conditions were in Ukraine. Hundreds of people, mainly homeless men, have frozen to death in parks, doorways, and underground passages. More snow is predicted in Europe in the days ahead. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
A damaged oil tanker off the British coast continues to leak oil into one of Britain's most important wildlife estuaries. The Sea Empress has lost 6 million gallons, and the spill has killed some 3,000 rare starfish. The holy month of Ramadan begins today. For many Muslims around the world, it's a day of gathering at mosques for morning prayers and visiting cemeteries. The month of fasting ends in a traditional feast. Today is also Fat Tuesday. More than 1 million partiers are expected to jam the New Orleans French Quarter for Mardi Gras celebrations to mark the last day of revelry before Lent begins. And the conference board today released a report showing a 0.2% rise in the index of leading economic indicators for December. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is Fat Tuesday, the last day of feasting and indulgence before Ash Wednesday and the beginning of Lent. In New Orleans, Fat Tuesday is celebrated with Mardi Gras. In Haiti, today costumed carnival bands parade through the streets. Traditionally, the costumes and instruments are set on fire in the wee hours of the night during the burning festival, which opens Lent. Tomorrow in Haiti, it's the beginning of Rara, a voodoo spiritual and musical festival that lasts until Easter. My guest, Elizabeth McAllister, has studied voodoo music and culture in Haiti and New York. She's produced a new CD of Haitian music recorded in the field and in the studio. The CD is called Rhythms of Rapture, Sacred Musics of Haitian Voodoo.
Zoali marché, li marché, li marché.
Zoali marché, li marché, li marché.
Koali marché, li marché, li marché.
Koali marché, koali marché. La ville non est bon Dieu.
Quoi marché non?
La ville non est bon Dieu.
Zoa marché non?
La ville non est bon Dieu.
Abolisad badi a ongasiye.
Isadorezo.
Abolisad badi a ongasiye.
Isadorezo.
Abolisad badi a ongasiye.
Isadorezo.
Elizabeth McAllister, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us what we've been listening to in this track that opens your collection, Rhythms of Rapture.
Bade is a song that was recorded by a group of Haitians who came to live in the United States sometime during the 70s. And what they've done is they've taken a traditional song from the countryside, which actually doesn't have any drumming in it, and they've sort of spun the lyrics to deal with the present situation in Haiti. When they recorded it in 94, there had been 2 years of a coup d'etat, the coup that ousted Aristide. So the song talks about how there must be change in Haiti and things must change. So they're incorporating a traditional opening prayer to a vodou ceremony with this sort of progressive idea that enough violence is enough and we've got to change things.
Now, is the opening of the track that we heard, does that sound similar to the opening of an actual ceremony?
Yeah, the prayer that he's saying in the very beginning is one of the opening prayers in any voodoo service. And it says, the bones walk, the body walks, but our life is in God's hands.
What does that mean?
It means here we are walking and talking and we're flesh and blood, but really God is giving us life. It's trying to remember that principle.
Elizabeth, the stereotypes, the Hollywood stereotypes of voodoo or sticking pins in dolls, casting evil spells, zombies. What is voodoo really?
Well, voodoo is a creolized and also a Christianized African-based religious system. It has elements from the Spanish colonial Catholicism as well as French Catholicism mixed with traditional Yoruba religion, Congo religion, the Fon religions of Dahomey, and other West African and Central African religious traditions. And this is a tradition that grew in Haiti from slavery times to the present. And it's really a full cultural system. We in the U.S. sort of call it a religion because we compartmentalize things. But it's a philosophy and a healing system and a religious system as well.
How did it get such a distorted reputation?
I think essentially The history of the United States with relationship to Haiti has been one of a power struggle and of attempted domination of Haiti. And from 1915 to 1934, as we all know, the U.S. Marines invaded that country. And every Marine captain got a book contract and came back home and wrote the very, very sensationalist books, which didn't understand the culture nor naturally, because they were soldiers and their job wasn't to be anthropologists. So that's the root of some of the Hollywood, the bad Hollywood films that started in the 40s and have continued to the present day.
Your CD features music that relates to Haitian voodoo. What is the importance of music in voodoo ceremonies?
Well, the ceremonies are absolutely beautiful. They're called service or dance. And they feature unbelievable beauty and artistry. And music is just one of the many components of the artistry in a voodoo service. Usually there's drumming, although not always. And it's the kind of three drum battery drumming that you also find in West Africa. And then a chorus of call and response singers sings over the drumming. And this is one of the ways that the gods or the spirits, they're called lua or they're called angels, are invoked. And so each spirit has many, many songs that name their name. And during the course of a ceremony, each spirit is sung to in the hopes that the spirit will come down and possess one of the dancers.
I'd like to play some music you recorded at a voodoo ceremony in Port-au-Prince in 1993. And tell us what this ceremony was about.
This was a really touching ceremony. It was a ceremony for two men who had traveled to the United States and had learned that they were HIV positive. Many, many people in Haiti do have HIV, and the AIDS crisis is very bad there. But not very many people get diagnosed. But these two guys had managed to make their way to some medical treatment in New York. So they knew that they were HIV positive, and they came back to Haiti to do a ceremony for the spirits, for their health. And this song is for an old goddess called Erzili, Gran Erzili, or Grandmother Erzili. And they're asking her for help in the course of the ceremony. And during the ceremony, they actually married her in a kind of a mystical marriage so that she would protect them. And the neat thing about this song is you can hear the drums breaking and bringing on spirit possession about maybe 20 seconds into the song.
What does that sound like?
Well, it's the mama drum slams very, very hard in a sort of a breaking, crossing through the rhythm kind of sound.
Music from a Haitian voodoo ceremony recorded by my guest Elizabeth McAllister and featured on a new CD that she produced called Rhythms of Rapture, Sacred Musics of Haitian Voodoo. So tell me more about what it means to be possessed in voodoo.
Well, many different kinds of social scientists have tried to work out what the meaning of possession is. Behavioral scientists call it an altered state of consciousness. Performance theory, people call it a possession performance, and they recognize that it's a learned cultural behavior. And different kinds of possession in different cultures look differently and look specific to that culture. But I prefer to bracket the question of what possession is and just take it from the position that the Haitians believe that the spirits are possessing people in voodoo, and therefore that's what's important. In other words, I try not to sort of solve the riddle of possession. it probably is some sort of altered state of consciousness. Certainly people can do extraordinary things in possession, like walk through a place where a fire has just been, like a very hot floor, or actually people have been known to eat glass bottles and chew them up. So certainly something is going on. Sort of not my job as an anthropologist to figure it out, but to rather recognize that the Haitians believe that the spirits are possessing the people in a ceremony, and that therefore the spirits have a special wisdom and a special counsel to dispense to their followers.
There's a song that you include on your new CD of Sacred Music of Haitian Voodoo that was written by a woman while she was possessed. The song is actually recorded by that woman's granddaughter. Tell us a little bit about this song before we hear it.
Oh, this is a beautiful story. The woman who sings this song is one of the lead singers and a founding member of Boukman Experience, which is a band in Haiti that mixes traditional voodoo musics with sort of the pop codes of rock and roll. And she sings this song a cappella with absolutely no instruments because she wanted to show the listeners how voodoo affects daily life and how even if you're sitting there shelling peas, you can be singing to the spirits, which is very common to find, you know, somebody in Haiti just sort of sitting there and singing. And she's singing a song which her grandmother first sang while she was possessed by a spirit long ago in the province where she was raised. Apparently, the spirit came and possessed her grandmother and just began to sing this song. And the song says, Ogun, who is the spirit of war and iron and discipline, Ogun, roi des anges, which means king of the angels, those people say that they're going to do me in. Those people are my enemies. What's going to happen to me? And in the same song, Ogun responds and says, ah, that's a joke. That's a game. I'm here. I'm protecting you. The angels are around you. You don't have to worry.
Let's hear the song.
Ogun, oh, roi des anges, lèm sonje pitit an wèn chwa lan wè. Chwa lan wèn paran Ogun, chwa lan wè. Lèm sonje pitit an wèn chwa lan wè. Ogun, oh, roi des anges, lèm sonje pitit an wèn chwa lan wè. Chwa lan wèn paran Ogun, chwa lan wè. Lèm sonje pitit an wèn chwa lan wè. Ogun, oh. Job la di la manje wen si se fwe, pa fout fwe, Ogun, oh. Job la di la manje wen si se fwe, men gen mon die, o gen lesen, oh. Job la di la manje wen se pa fwe, se pa fwe, timoun yo se pa fwe. Sa se jwè timoun yo, sa se blag, men gen mon die, O gen lesen yo, diable a di la manje mwen se pa vwe. Ogun, diable a di la manje mwen si se fwe, se pa fout fwe. Ogun, papa, diable a di la manje mwen si se fwe, men gen mon die. O gen lesen yo, diable a di la manje mwen se pa vwe. Pa vwe ti moun yo, se pa vwe. Sa se blak ti moun yo, sa se jwet, men gen mon die, o gen lesen yo, diable a di la manje mwen se pa fwe.
Music from the new CD, Rhythms of Rapture, Sacred Musics of Haitian Voodoo, produced by my guest Elizabeth McAllister. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with anthropologist Elizabeth McAllister. She's compiled a new CD called Rhythms of Rapture, Sacred Musics of Haitian Voodoo. Elizabeth, how did you start studying Haitian culture and voodoo?
It's kind of an unusual story for an anthropologist. I found the culture through the music, or first became attracted to it through the music. But unlike most anthropologists who tend to choose a field and go to the field, either by plane or by boat or however they get there, I started with Haitian immigrants who had moved into my neighborhood in upstate New York or in Rockland County, New York, which is just north of New York City. And in the 70s, there was a huge influx of Haitian immigrants to the New York area. And in junior high school, we had Haitians come into our classes, and they weren't very well received at first, I don't think, by the community. But my dad set up a cultural center. He was a Francophone and an educator, and he set up a small cultural center to help Haitian immigrants. And after a while, some old friends of mine, whose parents were also, as my father was, civil rights movement activists, we all started to take drumming lessons from some of the new Haitian immigrants. And one in particular, a master drummer named Frisner Augustin, took us under his wing and really began to teach me and these guys quite seriously. And these friends of mine were already percussionists. So what happened was Frisner, who was already known in the Haitian community as an excellent, excellent drummer, decided that the way that he would really prove himself was to show the Haitian community that he could teach these Anglo-American guys how to drum almost as well as he could. So he taught us, and he started taking us around to Vodou ceremonies in Brooklyn. And at that point, I was in college by then, and I was an anthropology major, and I realized the extraordinary phenomenon of African-based traditional religion thriving in New York City. After a while, Frisner took us back to Haiti, and in 1984, we all made our first trip, and we played in some Vodou ceremonies there and got to know what the religion looked like there. So it's unusual because first of all, it's unusual that I was with a group of friends who've now become sort of my extended family. And most anthropologists don't go into the field with other people. And it's also unusual that I sort of followed new immigrants back to their home countries and began to explore the culture that way.
So you say you've had the honor of assisting at dances in Haiti and New York. What does it mean to assist?
Well, the word in Creole when you go to a dance and participate is assister. They say, I'm going to assist in a dance, bral assister nan danse. And that means that you go and you lend whatever creative resources you have within yourself, whether it's singing or dancing or drumming or ritual, if you can perform ritual well, if you're initiated in the tradition. So what I would do is I would play bell, which is a relatively easy form of percussion, and it would enable me to stand rather than sit, so I had a good view, and I could sort of stand by the drummers, play the bell, be connected to the ceremony, but at the same time watch what was going on.
Is there a certain rhythm that you play?
Well, there are many, many rhythms within the tradition. We were taught in the sort of Port-au-Prince classic style, which is quite fast and quite intricate, and I can play the bell parts for all of those rhythms.
Can you tap it out on the table?
Well, let's see. There's a classic sort of 6-8, which goes like this. And a lot of the songs have that as the backbone.
Hmm. How do the drums function in voodoo ceremonies? Okay, let's go back to the movies for a second, where when you hear drumming, the zombies are starting to walk.
Right.
It always means something really ominous is about to happen. So how do drums really function in voodoo ceremonies?
Well, there are three drums, and they're a family. There's a mama, who's the biggest, deepest, most important one, the lead. There's a segon, which is the second drum, and then there's a piti, or a baby. And the piti sort of keeps the backbone of the rhythm and doesn't change too much during the course of the ceremony, and it's played with two long sticks on the drum head. The mama and the segon, meanwhile, are engaged in rolling rhythms back and forth, speaking with one another. And there's kind of a standard rhythm that's played during the singing. And then when the priest or the priestess who is holding a sacred rattle, it's a gourd actually covered with what used to be snake vertebrae in the antique times, but what's now usually plastic colored beads. When the priest or the priestess signals to the drummer and shakes this rattle, it means that the drummer should break. And a break is literally called casse, literally break, like breaks in all forms of music. And that means that the mama drum somehow plays against the rhythm. And this heats up the room, it heats up the music, it heats up the singing, and whoever's dancing actually gets caught in a sort of weird time warp, because if you're dancing to one rhythm and then the rhythm changes and there's a break, your feet are stepping down and there's no more mama there to support you rhythmically. So this is what's believed to sort of bring on the possession, this kind of dancing along, the rhythm changes, and then your body is thrown out of kilter and the spirits then can come and take over.
You were initiated into a voodoo society in 1988. What does it mean to be initiated?
Well, it means that you're part of an extended spiritual family. In the countryside in Haiti, actually, they don't do initiations because everyone is already part of an extended spiritual family by virtue of having been born in a compound. But in the city and in New York, people tend to go through an elaborate initiation ceremony, which in Haiti takes 7 days, and in New York they sort of economize time. It's been really interesting to observe this community over a few years, because what I've noticed is that a ceremony in Haiti that would take a month or 3 months gets reduced in New York to however much time people have before they have to go back to work.
Right.
So an initiation might take 4 days, so that somebody who's got a job in a hospital or driving a cab or whatever it is can just take off a day on either side of a weekend, or they can take a long weekend and be initiated. And what it means is that you are ritually competent to be a full participant in a service. It means you should know most of the dances and most of the songs, and you should know how to salute the spirits and how to pour libations of water or of alcohol on the floor for the spirits. You should know something about cooking for the spirits. And it means that you're part of a large family of other people in the religion. And it's conceived of as being going backward and forward in time. In other words, you're now part of a family that includes people who've already passed on, but who are watching and helping. And it means that you have sort of more ritual control over dealing with the spirits.
Elizabeth McAllister produced the CD Rhythms of Rapture, Sacred Musics of Haitian Voodoo, on the Smithsonian Folkways label. She'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
A futaí, bila bila,
onda
vache colgida. Não, não,
move tanto.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Elizabeth McAllister on Haitian voodoo music. Also, a performance by Boston-based singer-songwriter Dennis Brennan. He's been a local favorite for years. Now he's on his first tour at the age of 44. And is Black History Month doing what it should for African-American history? We have a commentary by Gerald Early.
Come on!
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Elizabeth McAllister. She studied voodoo culture in Haiti and New York and has produced a new CD called Rhythms of Rapture, Sacred Musics of Haitian Voodoo. You did some of your field work in Haiti, and you were in Haiti at about the time of the coup that overthrew Aristide. How did that coup affect the music that was being sung and the messages in the music?
It was really fascinating and heartbreaking to be there at that time. The people had elected Aristide with 67% of the vote or something like that, and they were overwhelmingly in support of him. And during the 7 months of Aristide's tenure, it was palpable in the streets. People were cleaning the streets more. People were in a hopeful mood. You could see small changes start to take over the country. And then the coup happened, and it was as if people's breath was taken away. It was just really hard. But, of course, life goes on, and people went on, and people still worshipped their gods and goddesses and still held voodoo ceremonies. So I had planned my field work the year before for my doctoral dissertation at Yale, and when the coup happened, I thought about it, and I assessed the situation, and I decided to go anyway and to take that into account in my field work. And it was really interesting because what happened was people, for one thing, would shift the dances from nighttime to daytime. There's an interesting kind of pan-Caribbean ethic of nocturnal dancing. And some anthropologists think that it started in slavery days when people really only had the liberty to dance at night. But certainly till the present time, many, many dances throughout the Caribbean or occasions like Christmases, carnivals, will start around 9 or 10 at night and they'll go to daybreak. And in fact, if something doesn't go to daybreak, it's sort of not successful. So this is very much the code in Haitian voodoo, but during the coup period, if you finished your dance and tried to walk home at 5 in the morning, you might well be assassinated. And so people shifted the dances to the daytime hours so that things started around 11 in the morning and people danced all day till about nightfall, and then they made their way home through the slums and back to their homes. The other interesting thing was that people began to use traditional songs as metaphors for their view on the military government and on the coup, so that Ogun, who, as I've said before, is the god of war and discipline and soldiering, became a sort of a code word for the army. And people were singing songs for Ogun, but it was clear that what they were talking about was army abuses. And there's a popular festival that I particularly paid attention to called Rara, which Rara bands dispatch huge amounts of people through the streets during Lent, and they sing both traditional songs and carnival songs. And many, many traditional songs got this new inflection. Like, I remember there was one called that said Sodo Mprale, which means I'm going to Sodo. And Sodo is the site of a huge voodoo pilgrimage for Ezili, one of the goddesses. So Sodo Mprale, I'm going to Sodo, meant I want the army to go. So any song with I'm going in it kind of got interpreted as we want the army to go. And it was really fascinating because it usually took about 2 weeks for the army to catch on. So what would happen is the bands would parade around and they'd have this new meaning that usually got explained to me by friends or by my field assistant because it wasn't too obvious. But then 2 weeks later, either that song wouldn't be sung anymore, or what happened was the bands were menaced in the streets. Army people would come with guns and tell them to go home or even open fire on them. So within 2 weeks time, a traditional song could go from having just a traditional meaning to having this new politicized meaning to then being repressed by the military.
Do you have an example of one of those songs on your CD?
Well, in a way I do. I have a song, track 8. There's a song on the CD called Guantanamo Rara song, which is this kind of street procession song. And it's actually much more explicit than the process I just described. they're saying that they were dying of hunger in Haiti, so they sold everything they had, which is kind of cute. They say, we sold our pigs, we sold our goats to go to Miami. And what happened was they really, members of that musical community, had gone on a boat to try to get to Miami. And of course, they were intercepted by the U.S. Coast Guard and taken to Guantanamo. So they were complaining and saying they went to Miami. All their family thought they were working in good jobs. And really, they were sitting in Guantanamo suffering, only to be sent back to die of hunger in the streets of Haiti. So it shows how each song in Vodou and in Rara is like has sort of a soap opera behind it. Most of the songs are sending a message, and most of them are relating something that the community was going through at the time.
Rara is a kind of band?
Right. A Rara band is a musical band that grows out of Vodou temples, but it's its own activity, and it's Rara is a festival that starts right after Carnival ends on Ash Wednesday and continues through the 6 weeks of Lent to climax on Easter weekend. And on Easter weekend, bands go out. Bands can be anywhere from 15 people in an extended family to hundreds of people in a community. They go out and they parade through the streets and they sing traditional songs or they sing messages towards whoever's in power.
Well, let's hear the song that you recorded about Guantanamo. That's music from the new CD, Rhythms of Rapture, Sacred Musics of Haitian Voodoo, produced by my guest, Elizabeth McAllister. She's an anthropologist who actually recorded the track that we just heard. Elizabeth, what were the wind instruments playing the rhythm?
Right, they're actually long bamboo tubes that have been cut to produce whatever sound they want. A short one will produce a high pitch, and a long one will produce a low pitch. And it's played by hocketing, which is a technique that may have been inherited from Central Africa, from the Pygmies, the Mbutu people. What they do is each guy, usually it is a guy, chooses, he has his one note that he plays, and he gets in a circle with five other guys, and each one of them plays a note in at a point in the rhythm so that it creates a melody together.
Hmm.
So it's a real communal kind of a performance style, and it requires exquisite rhythmic sense and a great lung capacity.
Now, your father, when you were young, set up a Haitian cultural center in New York, was it?
Right, in Nyack, New York, which is right across the Hudson from Westchester.
Do you have any other family connections to ethnomusicology?
Not ethnomusicology per se, but my uncle, my late uncle Timothy Ash, was a pretty well-known ethnographic filmmaker. And when I was little, he was working with the Yanomamo in the Amazon in Brazil. And he was a real source of inspiration for me. He was always running around the house yelling about trips they were going to take and cameras, and everything was exciting with him. They, instead of furniture, they had hammocks strung up all over the house from his trips to Brazil. So as kids, we played all over the hammocks, and I thought, this is the life. I want to do this.
You've spent so much time studying Voodoo, and you've even been initiated into Voodoo. Has your experiences with Voodoo changed your mindset at all? Do you have a different perspective on things or on trouble or, your own, you know what I mean?
I think it has changed me subtly, perhaps, but in Voodoo, there's a huge emphasis on lineage and on family and on not worshiping it. That sort of sounds like, primitive people worship things, but on being mindful of the ancestors and on what people did who came before you. So ironically, I began to, rather than sort of lose myself and go native and declare that I'm actually Haitian, I began to really reflect on my own family background more and to appreciate my own family, who share a history in a way with the Haitian country, in that my family, one line is, we're British pilgrims or British immigrants who came to Massachusetts and then the colony of New Hampshire in 1634. And another line came from Britain to the colony of Bermuda in the 1500s. I've been thinking a lot more about them and about their lives and how the history of the Caribbean really touches my own family line as well.
Elizabeth McAllister, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth McAllister produced the CD Rhythms of Rapture, Sacred Musics of Haitian Voodoo, on the Smithsonian Folkways label. McAllister is a postdoctorate fellow at the Rutgers Center for Historical Analysis. She's a contributor to the exhibit Sacred Arts of Haitian Voodoo, on view through June at the UCLA Fowler Museum of Cultural History. This is Fresh Air. Dennis Brennan is a singer, songwriter, and guitarist who has described his brand of rock as totally unfashionable. Nevertheless, he's been pretty popular in Boston, where he lives, yet most of his life he's had to hold down day jobs. He even briefly gave up performing to take a job as a warehouse foreman. Now at the age of 44, he's quit his job, and he has his first CD under his own name. It's called Jack in the Pulpit. Jeffrey Himes wrote in the Washington Post that it proves that blue-collar retro rock is as artistically vital as it is commercially moribund. We asked Dennis Brennan to stop by and play one of his original songs that's also included on the new CD. It's called Teresa, and as you'll hear, it's inspired by Tex-Mex ballads.
Down on this road, there ain't much to do, so I just close my eyes and dream about you. You and that guy I met once or twice. That's all right, honey, I just hope he's treating you nice. Things here ain't so bad, I've made some friends. They make me laugh, but I can't pretend. When the night gets cold and I get blue, honey, I just wanna hold on to you. Oh, Teresa, Teresa, my dear, I stand accused and I'm guilty, I fear. We've lived our lives in a corner called hell. Now you're out there and I'm in the cell. And if you can't be here by midnight, if all of your connections fail, say a prayer for me, finger your rosary, or I will have left this jail. I will see the cell door open, I'll hear the tolling bells. And if you can't be here by midnight, darling, I'm wishing you well. Every day I recall how I got to this place. I woke up one night with a gun in my face. I saw a badge, I saw blue. That boy couldn't have been more than 22. I heard his scream, I grabbed his gun. He broke free and he started to run. Back of the head, it wasn't clean. Meanest thing that I've ever seen. Oh, Teresa, Teresa, my dear, I stand accused and I'm guilty, I fear. We've lived our lives in a corner called hell. Now you're out there and I'm in this cell. And if you can't be here by midnight, If all of your connections fail, say a prayer for me. Finger your rosary, for I will have left this chair. I will see the cell door open. I'll hear the tolling bells. And if you can't be here by midnight, darling, I'm wishing you well. I'm wishing you well. I'm wishing you well.
Dennis Brennan playing his song Teresa, and that song is also included on his new album, Jack in the Pulpit. Now, what came first for you, singing, writing, playing guitar?
Singing. I sang Louie Louie at a town hall dance when I was 14 years old. And I was in rock bands, and I played bass for a little bit in high school. You know how things break up. The bass player left, so I had to learn how to play bass. I did that. And then after high school, I really became fixated and fascinated by soul music and rhythm and blues.
Like, and who just, in particular?
Most of the Stax Volt stuff and the Southern things that were going on. I just really thought that was the songwriters like Don Covey and Bobby Womack, things like that, just completely floored me. And I moved from the small town that I came from, Berlin, which is in the middle of the state of Massachusetts, a little dairy town, and moved to Boston and got in a band with a bunch of like-minded people, but we were sort of, it was Don Quixote. Like we'd be playing all these songs that nobody ever heard. We didn't care if they were popular. Most of them were album cuts and everything. But they, as far as we were concerned, they were great songs. They were things like stuff off Bobby Womack's record, "More Than I Can Stand," and some James Brown stuff that weren't big hits, but were great songs. And we just sort of find them and do them. And we got a small following, but it never translated into a recording contract or anything.
Want to do a little bit of James Brown for us?
Say what? Oh no! I couldn't do that.
Your acoustic guitar.
No, that's about it.
How about something else from your Stax Volt era?
Okay. Well, I can't. Let me see. I can probably do a. The first song that we had that was popular, that got played on the radio, it went to number one on our little local charts. The radio station would play tapes and everything. Was a song that I had sort of ripped from Bobby Womack, and I could probably play a verse for you or something.
Good.
So it's I haven't done this in a long time. I've got my reasons, and there's more than a few. Why I spend so much time trying to avoid you. I start to lose control when I know that you're near. Just can't get a grip, baby, when I'm covered in this fear. Here's the part I really stole from Bobby Womack. When the sun beats up and my knees get weak, tongue gets tied and I can't seem to speak, I realize I'm out of time. Your love is catching up with me.
I can't believe I'm doing this.
All right, that's enough of this.
Why is it so surprising to you?
Because I haven't done this song in 20 years, in 15 years. It's been a long time.
Now, tell me about developing your voice when you started to sing.
Well, especially when I discovered that I really love soul music, it became sort of a problem because the people that I admired had great voices, and they were all black. They're all black, and it became a strange thing. There was this sort of thing in the 70s where there were a lot of bands that were sort of having hit records, but they had, black sounding singers, and they obviously had been in bar bands for years and everything. And the band I was in, the Martells, was kind of like that, but I just couldn't do that thing. I couldn't do the white the white boy, sing that funky music white boy type of thing. I couldn't do it. It always came out sounding like some sort of country guy singing, and that's why I sort of gravitated towards the more rural type soul music, the Stax Fold thing, because that sort of felt more comfortable to me rather than the slick stuff.
You're in your 40s now. You're on your first tour. A lot of performers go on the first tour when they're in their 20s or maybe even in their teens. Mm-hmm. Do you feel disappointed that you're doing it so much later, or are you just glad to be doing it?
When I decided I was going to go play and do my own stuff, I sort of told myself that I wasn't going to think about let things like that bother me. I mean, there's the old Muddy Waters story about, you know, after he got discovered by the you know, young white crowd in the 60s in the blues revival and everything, you know, they had asked him basically the same question: how do you feel about that? And he said, well, you know, I wish they had known me, I wish they'd gotten me when I was, you know, in my prime, when I was, because he was in his 50s by then. I wish he had gotten a hold of me, you know, when I was really doing it. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I just figured out how to do this time. Well, there's a reason why that, you know, I'm doing it now. And the reason why is because I just didn't have it together before, really. And it wasn't until I really figured out what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it that I'm doing this now. So I don't have any second thoughts about it. I'm glad to be out doing this now and enjoying myself.
Dennis Brennan, thanks a lot for
being
with us. Dennis Brennan's new CD is called Jack in the Pulpit. It's on Upstart Records, which is distributed by Rounder. Coming up, some thoughts on Black History Month. This is Fresh Air. Black History Month has become an established observance in mainstream America. Schools, government offices, and many organizations officially celebrate in some way. Writer and teacher Gerald Early wonders if all the ceremonies actually lead to a greater understanding of African American history.
It's February, which means we've arrived at another Black History Month. Enterprising Harvard-trained black historian Carter G. Woodson started this celebration in 1926 with Negro History Week. As his biographer Jacqueline Goggin noted, Woodson wanted, quote, to increase awareness of and interest in black history among the black masses. He also wanted to promote support for his organization, the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History. In the early 1970s, after the convulsions of the Black Power Movement, Negro History Week became Black History Month. In some quarters today, it is African American History Month. National consideration of the black experience in the United States now takes up more than 2 months of the year. First, there is the Kwanzaa holiday from December 26 to January 1st that has become a time for black Americans to think about their African heritage. Then there is the Martin Luther King holiday on January 15th, a time when the nation reflects on the meaning of the civil rights movement. That blacks have brought their experience to such intense and prolonged notice is an incredible feat, especially as it was largely through their own doing. No other ethnic group in the United States has such official notice of its existence or its national importance. Black history displays are everywhere. It has become a marketer's dream as Black History Month has become another act of consumption. Publishers use this month to dump many of their black books into bookstores. If, in this age of self-awareness, blacks are the most oppressed group, then they would need the most occasions to celebrate themselves. It seems we've arrived at the point of having separate but equal versions of American history. As a director of an African-American studies program, I am often called upon during this month to give talks. Virtually every institution, white and black, has a Black History Month celebration. I have spoken to audiences as diverse as inner-city elementary school students to the workers at a local IRS office. My audiences are always captive and usually never very interested in what I have to say. Children squirm in their seats. Adults look at their watches. Blacks look dutiful. Whites look glum. What is expected is a kind of pep talk or morale booster for blacks about how great we were in Africa, how bravely and heroically we resisted in slavery, how wonderful our leaders, our inventors, our writers, our musicians, how far we have fallen from our ancestors now, and how we need to adopt the old ways to achieve our greatness as a people. This is a black version of a Puritan Jeremiad. It works the way any Jeremiad works, an exhausted formula for civic virtue and identity. A school teacher will come up to me and tell me how important I am as a role model to her black students who have as much interest in my recitation on Douglass or Du Bois as Italian-American kids would were I an Italian-American speaking about Columbus or Marconi. And why am I not a role model for any kid? And why can't a black kid pick his own role model of any color? History, as Nietzsche has taught us, has its uses and abuses. Have we Americans, black and white, really learned how to use black history yet? Black History Month teaches us that it is no easy task for both blacks and whites, through rituals and formula, to find what is so sorely needed, a common, usable past.
Gerald Early directs the African and Afro-American Studies Department at Washington University in St. Louis. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Joan Tui Westman. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.